My name is Tony, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Luke will read the preamble.
Luke, alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Parrots will read the steps.
The 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs.
And Michelle will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Michelle. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, okay.
The traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Harrison.
Perfect. Good evening, Atlanta Group. My name is Harrison, and I'm an alcoholic. It's an honor to be speaking to you tonight. I started coming around about a year ago, and I had no intention of doing any steps. I had no intention of getting a sponsor, and I had no intention of getting to know any of you. I basically came around. I had experience with AA before. I had been in it a few times. And my goal was to attend the Wednesday night Big Book meeting and learn a little bit about the disease, and I was going to take what information I learned and just take off. But my things didn't go according to my plan, and that's just as well. I would show up at the Wednesday night Big Book meeting, and people would ask me who my sponsor is, and why don't I come to the Tuesday night meeting? Why don't I come to the Thursday night meeting? And I really didn't want to talk to anybody, so I would lie or just change the subject. One night, somebody introduced me to a guy named Todd. He seemed like a nice enough guy, and he started telling me his story. And I knew where it was leading, and I was, you know, I was like, oh no, and I tried to get away from him, and he said, why don't, you know, I said, you know, I'm, you know, I appreciate your help, but I'm really not interested in having a sponsor, and he said, okay, why don't you give me a call tomorrow before noon? So I called him, and again, I reiterated what, that I don't want a sponsor, and he said, that's okay, give me a call tomorrow before noon. And I've been calling him just about every day since then. I was born and raised in South Jersey, about 15 minutes outside of Philadelphia. I come from a large Catholic family, lots of uncles, lots of aunts, lots of cousins, lots of love. Very good start. Somewhere along the line in grade school, I started feeling very different than my classmates. I felt very much alone, very isolated. I just could not connect with my classmates, and soon I couldn't connect with my family. I just could not connect with any, just about any other human being on this planet. And I had what I know now as being irritability, restlessness, and discontent. Always and everywhere, restlessness, irritability, and discontent. When I was 14, I had my first drink, and this changed the world for me in ways I could not imagine. It took away all that restlessness, all that irritability, and all that discontent. It made me feel part of the human race, and I loved it from the very first time I had alcohol. By the time I was 20 years old, I was a blackout drinker. I would wake up at mornings, or usually it was in the afternoon, and I would be terrified as to what might have happened the night before. And I would call up friends, and I had friends at the same time who were experiencing blackouts, and I never heard of this phenomenon before. I didn't know what it was about, but it scared me. Still, I didn't slow down my drinking. I continued to suffer blackouts. After one such blackout, I woke up in the hospital. I woke up in a hospital bed. There was blood on my shirt. I didn't know what it was from. I got up off the hospital bed. I checked my body to see if I had a bullet wound or a stab wound. No, everything was fine. My head really hurt. So I got off the bed and went to the mirror in the hospital room, and my face was swollen unbelievably, and my jaw was frozen shut. So I took my hands, and I pried open my jaw, and I looked inside, and a bunch of teeth were gone. And I had no idea, I have no recollection of what happened, who did it, or why it happened. My mother came to get me from the hospital that morning, and she was in tears. She was crying, and she kept on saying, what happened to you? Why does this always happen to you? What are we going to do with you? I had no answers for her. basically, someone told her about AA. She told me that I should start going to AA. I went to one meeting. I walked in, and I expected a bunch of old guys sitting around complaining that they couldn't drink anymore. But I went to this meeting, and it was rather young, and it was big, and people were clapping, and they were happy, and I hated it. It was not what I wanted. So I came home, and I told my mother, I said, you know, it's really not for me. It's a cult. They talk a lot about God, and I don't understand what I don't understand what God has to do with anything. So AA is not for me. I'm going to try to quit drinking on my own. This lasted only a very short while, but I still were getting these blackouts. So, I had the brilliant idea, well, I should be snorting more cocaine. That'll keep these blackouts from happening. And that just took me down roads. Just things got worse. I went on to get a DUI. Then I got a second DUI. The second DUI was horrible. I was in a horrible car accident that I had caused. I didn't have a driver's license. I did not have car insurance. I did not have a registration. I had stolen license plates on my car. My car was totaled. The other car was totaled. I was in a lot of trouble and never so scared in my life. There was a long drawn out criminal case, a long drawn out civil case, and I paid through the nose for years through that. I was destitute, jobless, everything, things were bad, and every day I thought about suicide. But I still did not want to do AA, and I accumulated some dry time. And this was down in Philadelphia. I started going to a few meetings down there, but there was never any talk of steps or big book, not that I remember, and that didn't last very long. I moved to New York, and I was scared of the worried about my drinking because I was blacking out, and there was always trouble. So I started drinking alone in my apartment. And I would black out in my apartment all alone. And it got to the point where I was a daily drinker. I would get up, first thing I do, go to the liquor store. I had like a little rotation going on. I didn't want to get a reputation in any of the liquor stores. So I every day it was like a bottle of vodka, plastic bottles of vodka, jug wine. I didn't have any money. The cheapest alcohol I could afford. And it went like that. It went on and on like that. Eventually, I got a job. I didn't quit drinking. And once again, I was in trouble. I was about to get fired from my job. And in order to keep from getting fired, I told my boss that, hey, I'm an alcoholic, hoping to get some sympathy for her. She did have sympathy. And she told me, well, you got to go to meetings. You got to get a sponsor. And I had heard this before. So as I had just told you, I came around and started coming around to the Atlantic group and, started talking to Todd every day. I started coming to Tuesday and Thursday night. And at first I was freaked out and I didn't feel like I fit in. It seemed like everyone here was from the Upper East Side. I don't live on the Upper East Side. Everyone here was too enthusiastic. I'm not enthusiastic. It's just not for me. Todd would tell me, it's all in your head. It's all your self-centered fear. And I'm like, well, maybe it is. So I started coming around. And thank God I did. Because, had it not been for me coming around to the Atlantic group, the way I drink, I'm a dead man. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I had been in alcohol rehab before. I had woke up in hospitals. I had woke up in jail cells. And that's waiting for me again. And I'm terrified of that prospect. This year, I had some familiarity with the steps. I never did them. I thought I knew what they were about. I thought, why do I have to do them? I know what they are. But Todd took me through the steps one at a time. 1, 2, 3. Got to step 4. And I was like, why do I got to do a step 4? I've been thinking about my resentments for years. They've been churning around in my mind. Harm's done others. I've been thinking about that. But when I finally got them down on paper and saw my role in my resentments, it was a 180 degree shift in my thinking. It was just unbelievable. Like it was always the world that was my problem. It was never me. I was always blaming everybody. The car accidents, the missing teeth, it was not my fault. It was someone else's. But it's true. It was my fault. And that came through clearly in the fourth step. Went on to do a step 5, 6, and 7, 8, and now I'm about to move to step 9. God, all these, you know, so many people in the past. I was like this Tasmanian devil of destruction in people's lives. Broken relationships, broken, you know, fired from jobs. My mind was broken. I mean, my bones, I mean, everything. It was just a horrible, you know, I drank for a period of time that can be measured in decades. It was a long time, and it was, you know, 95% of it was just misery. And I'm just grateful to be here with you people here tonight. And really, you people here in the Atlantic Group have helped keep me alive, each and every one of you. And before I go, I'd like to thank my sponsor, Todd, who, you know, I bristle just about everything he tells me, but I try to listen, and I'm still here. I'd like to thank my sober brothers, Jeff, Joe G., Greg, and especially Joe Reynolds, who I speak to on a daily basis, and our conversations span the spectrum of sanity and sobriety. And I would like to thank my coworker and fellow friend of Bill, Emma. Raise your hand, Emma. Let's get a look at you. every day I see Emma, and she's just a daily dose of experience, strength, and hope. And thank you, everyone.
And our second 10-minute speaker is Elizabeth.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. My name is Elizabeth Young, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sponsor is Peggy B. My sobriety date is May 2nd, 1999. And that's it. That's all I need to say. Okay, this is my home group, and it's an honor and a privilege to speak. So many faces I know, amazing relationships and friendships I have in this room. Thank you so much, Harrison. The moment you said, get out, you said something about, you know, going into the big book meeting, getting the information and getting out, it was like a big red thing that went off inside of me. And that's been my experience from birth. You know, I want to get out. Growing up, my background, I grew up in alcoholism, grew up in a really violent household. I learned to be silent, quiet, hide. Don't draw attention to yourself. You know, the way that I sort of coped in the beginning before I picked up alcohol was I stole all the time. And I was mean. I was angry, and I stole. And then I had a friend once in like grade school remind me how we started talking. I didn't know how to communicate with people. I didn't know how to have relationships, conversations. I just missed that part or something. I was so filled with fear, so much fear. So by the time I picked up a drink, it was I drank for effect. I mean, that's why I drank. I never really remembered my first drink, but the last couple of weeks working with a new sponsee on her first step, I have had this recollection of this experience I had in high school. I think it was maybe ninth grade or something. I remember going to a party, and I think this was my first sort of experience with alcohol. I remember going to a party and drinking tequila and Sprite, and the guy that was pouring them and then banging them on the table, I remember standing in front of him and just drinking, just keep drinking until someone sort of pushed me, like, okay, it's my turn. And then I remember his face. There was disgust. He was older. He was like 2 years ahead of me in grade, and he had must have drank before, and he kind of looked at me like, you know, just disgust, you know, and this is the classic story for all of my drinking. And that's all I remember. I remember being helped to the restroom by a number of people, and then I don't really remember anything. I don't remember anything else. Not really. I don't remember anything else. And that was my first experience with alcohol, and I just wanted to get out of myself. My experience through the years was I tried control drinking. Because I was in high school, peer pressure, and when I drank, I never knew what I was going to do. I never knew what I would look like, what I would say, and I worried about what people thought of me, go figure. And so I would try not to drink, but, you know, anybody that is new, I know when I first got here, I didn't know this. I didn't know that when I put any amount of alcohol into my body, that I have no control over the amount that I take, that it sets off a physical craving and that I crave more. I didn't know I was an alcoholic because I would have periods of not drinking for long, you know, weeks, or even one time I almost went like 9 months, almost close to a year of not drinking. I ended up in a mental institution, I'll tell you that in a minute. But I didn't drink alcohol, and so I had a lot of denial or delusion. You know, I always hear, I can hear Jeff saying, it's delusion. So I had a lot of delusion in, and my dad was, you know, the classic, like, drunk, violent, beat people up. That was an alcoholic in my mind, and I wasn't that. I became that. But at the time, you know, I wasn't that, or I couldn't see that about myself. So it was a lot of delusion through the years, you know. And my experience with drinking was I would drink alcohol. It was like Russian roulette. Sometimes I could have a couple drinks and go to bed and there would be no problem. And often there was a lot of violence and a lot of wreckage. It was like the Tasmanian devil thing. I identify with that, ripping through. And a lot of disgust. You know, I remember my mother one day coming into the bathroom in the house I grew up in and just looking at me. And I was so filled with, you know, and this was sober. I didn't have alcohol that day. I was so filled with rage and I just broke something. And she looked at me and she was like, what is wrong with you? You know, what is wrong with you? And my whole life, before I got here, until I got here, I didn't know what was wrong with me. Thank you. And I am so grateful that I'm an alcoholic because, thank God, you know, there's a solution in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a solution to what's wrong with me. And I don't have to live like that anymore today. You know, I get a daily reprieve based on my spiritual maintenance. That's what they told me when I first came in. What brought me to AA in the first place was Al-Anon, because I had alcoholism in my family. It was all their fault. I identify again, their fault. They're the problem. You know, I rammed into your car, but you said something to me that made me mad to do it, you know? And so I was always blaming. I couldn't see, period. And this woman would come into this Al-Anon meeting once a week. Now, mind you, I was drinking, so Al-Anon's a wonderful program, but it doesn't work if you're drinking. And you're an alcoholic, of course. So I would go to this meeting once a week, and I had a sponsor, a name in Al-Anon, and I didn't call her, and I didn't work steps, and I didn't read literature, but I would get relief. You know, I got that little bit of relief you get when you go to a meeting. That doesn't last, by the way. And this woman came in with a baby every week, a 9-month-old baby. And what blew me away, you know, this is a program of attraction, and what blew me away was that the baby was clean and it had clothes and it looked like it was fed, and she would share things that I thought were outrageous. I couldn't believe some of the things she said in public, this woman who called herself a double winner. And I identified, you know. One day I just went up to her and said, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And she said, oh, I'm speaking at a meeting. Why don't you come? And it was kind of like that whole, why don't you call me tomorrow before noon? You know, they got me. And I came in, I went to a meeting, it happened to be 2 blocks from my home by, you know, coincidence, God, my God, that I found here in these rooms, and I've been coming ever since, and what they told me to do in the beginning is what I do today. You know, they told me, I don't go to 90 meetings in 90 days today, but they told me in the beginning, 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, get a home group, get a service commitment, and those are the things that I still do today that keep me sober. And my life has changed. You know, I was thinking about my mom and the disgust on her face, and, you know, this guy from high school, like, people don't look at me like that anymore. You know, this weekend my mother was at my wedding, and she gave me a card, and in the card she wrote how proud of me she was for the brilliant and confident woman that I have become. And I'm like, what? You know, and that is a result of getting a sponsor, working the step work, because I was clueless. You know, this book still baffles me. I was reading it today and going, oh my God, I didn't see that before. You know, and I'm here almost 9 years. And working the step work, making amends to my family members, having a relationship with a sponsor has enabled me to have a relationship with sponsees, has enabled me to have a relationship with a partner that is really human, you know, and I'm living life on life's terms. But the good news is that no matter what's put on my plate on a daily basis, I never feel that seeking anymore. I don't feel like I have to find something. You know, I tried everything, self-help, gurus, satsang, silent retreats, drugs, institutions, you know, mental wards, all of it. I tried it, and it didn't work. If it worked, I wouldn't be here. This book worked. Recently, somebody stayed in my apartment this weekend, and she said, oh, I'm reading this book on your shelf, and it was some other practice that other people do that's great for them. And she said, you know, I can't take that book. I want to leave it. I know that it means a lot to you. And I'm like, no. Like, I live by the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got that book when I was seeking. I'm not seeking anymore, so you can have the book. And she's like, really? Thank you. I have 1 minute. That to me is amazing, you know, because my whole life was this desperateness, and I just don't have that today. I've repaired relationships, I just want to say, with my, I grew up with two fathers, a stepfather and a biological father. This disease took my biological father last year. You know, this disease kills. He came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and then he left. And then he came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he left. And he couldn't get it. I don't know why he couldn't get it. I don't know why he's dead and I'm here. But I do know I have a responsibility. I have a responsibility to the women I sponsor. I have a responsibility to the newcomer in this room to reach my hand out. I have a responsibility to my friends in Alcoholics Anonymous to be there, to be, you know, this is my family. This is my family. And, you know, if you don't feel a part of, if you feel like, I don't feel like that, I'm new, I don't feel like this is my family, get a service commitment and just keep coming and give me your number tonight. We'll start calling each other. Like, that's how it works. I had to take uncomfortable actions to get the things that I have in my life today. And I still have to take uncomfortable actions sometimes to grow because my life is so huge today. So I'm just grateful. Thank you so much. I love the Atlanta Group.
Tonight's meetings can be purchased from Taylor and Phil at the audio table at next week's meeting. Additionally, AA speaker tapes may be borrowed from the lending library. As was said, this meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see remain here. If you are speaking at another group and wish some of us to come for support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. And our main speaker tonight is Colin.
I'm Colin. I'm an alcoholic. And I need to be here tonight. I had kind of semi-rehearsed what I was going to say, and it's all gone out the window. I was just tremendously moved by people counting days. And it put me back to when I counted days, which I started doing on November the 16th, 1986. And I remember not to put off any day counters that, like, the first year was, I mean, it was kind of bumpy, but it was okay. And then I hit the terrible twos. And I realized, you know, the second year, you know, not drinking was the easy part. Now I'm in my 20th year, and I've got kind of the terrible 20s. And I've just done another fourth and fifth step and sixth and seventh. And I'm finding myself, I don't know, not exactly, I'm getting jealous of various stuff. I mean, particularly on sort of sex. And I'm beginning to sort of think, you know, like, I didn't get my share. And then I realize, you know, when I was drinking, my sex included child prostitutes, abortions, boy prostitutes. I never had a decent relationship with anyone, and ultimately lost all interest in sex because, you know, if the woman was at one side of the room and the bottle was at the other, I always went to the bottle. And I remember being in a sort of a very nice hotel in Los Angeles once, and there was a young woman there that wanted to be a photographer, and I worked for Life magazine in those days. And she kind of came up to the room, and I made this sort of half-hearted pass at her, and she said, "No, thank you." And it was kind of a relief, because then I could drink. And the next thing I knew, you know, I was lying on the floor, and I had long hair in those days, and she was pounding my head on the floor saying, "You win." And I had absolutely no interest. I mean, drinking was what I wanted to do. And I remember, you know, when I started drinking, it was like rocket fuel. It was miracle. It was miracle stuff. And it enabled me to do all sorts of things. And I had an amazing career. And for years, you know, I drank and drank, and I tripped ever upwards. You know, I'd have perfectly good jobs, and I'd walk out of them. I used to work on Fleet Street, and I came over here after getting drunk in a pub and saying that's what I was going to do. Yeah, I went all over the States. I lived in Asia for a long time. Yeah, I covered the Vietnam War and had an expense account. And it was never like, "Oh, I'm fearful. I think I'll have another one." I just had another one. And my character defects may have been down there, but I didn't care about them because they didn't seem to matter. And, you know, this went on for years, and finally, you know, I sort of started walking out of jobs, you know, with, you know, the faintest little insult or whatever. And the gaps between getting the next job got a bit longer, and then the next jobs began to get a bit worse, and then, yeah, you're sort of faking a resume by a year instead of a couple of months. And it just got worse and worse and worse, and I just drank myself down and down and down. And I still didn't see, you know, what the problem was until I was always very lucky making money. And I sort of semi-retired when I was about 40. And then I got married, and then we had a kid, and then the money ran out, and I started drinking more and more and more, and I kind of diddled around with the drugs, but drugs were never really part of my story. They were, you know, a bit like beer. It's something you did while you were waiting for the whiskey. And I don't know when sort of despair set in, but I know I drank in despair for at least 10 years. And my wife and I had kind of given up on having a baby, and then the baby arrived, and I remember sort of sitting in our apartment, kind of glaring at the baby and kind of not wishing her ill, but really, really wishing the hell she wasn't there. And I felt the same about my wife. And I'd sit in the chair, you know, at night and I'd have a scotch in one hand and the real estate ads in the other. I'd be looking for like a studio apartment for myself, and I'd be furnishing it, you know, like I'd put my roll top desk over there and stuff like that. And it was like I was living like this sort of pretend life of aloneness. And I knew I was drinking a lot, but I was one of those alcoholics, which I'm not unique, who thought, "Well, you'd drink too if you had my problems." And I knew too that I was probably an alcoholic because my dad had been an alcoholic, and he died like about 5 years before this. But he died sober. He died with 18 years. And I remember very soon after he got into AA, he dragged my mother and my brother and myself off to hear Bill Wilson. And I don't remember a thing about it. It'd be great to say, you know, I remember these ringing phrases. Well, I just remember this room with more people than there are in this room now. And it was thick with cigarette smoke, and there was this very tall kind of gray-haired yank kind of droning on the stage, and I just couldn't wait to get out of there. And I don't know how, I do know how I got here. I got here through a divine intervention. And And one day, you know, I went to see the doctor at the place I worked, and he was a doctor I'd known in Vietnam. We used to smoke pot together there. And I said, I just couldn't stop drinking. And I can't remember all the details I told him, but at this point, I'd already attempted suicide. And one day we had a house up in the country, and I remember being under a barbed wire fence with a shotgun, and I had the barrel under my chin and the trigger on one of the barbs, and I took off anyone who's fired a shotgun, it's got two pressures on the trigger. And I'd taken I had the first pressure, and then I changed my mind, but I changed my mind with the barrel kind of rammed like an inch into, and I was quite tubby in those days too, rammed really into my chin. And there was snow on the ground, and I was freezing. I mean, I was getting and I knew that, if I didn't get out soon, that I would die of freezing if I didn't pull the trigger by shivering. And, I managed to pull the gun away from under my chin. And I was always thinking of ways of having these sort of accidents so that my wife and kid would get the insurance. And another time I had a handgun, and I remember cleaning it, and leaving one round in it and thinking, well, I just put one through my ear. And, they get the insurance that way. And, and I told the doctor some of this, and he said, well, you look like shit. I mean, that was his medical opinion. And so I'm not using bad language. I'm quoting a doctor. And also, I mean, I was very blotchy. My shins were covered with scabs. And I told him also I'd had no control over my bowels for about 3 years. And I was always pooping myself, and my solution for this was to keep spare trousers. And, I'd carry them in my briefcase. I had them in my office. I used to change on subway platforms. I changed in taxis. And, I mean, it was just totally disgusting. And I looked like the sort of person that, I've heard in AA meetings, let's have a group conscience and not let me in. And so I'm not in favor of banning people from AA meetings. Anyway, he convinced me, it was probably time to go into a detox, which is what I did. And I did 5 days up in Roosevelt and then 28 days in Smithers. And I think the only thing that really sank in at Smithers was that if I didn't want to drink, I had to go to meetings. And it seemed like an enormous price to pay, because I found meetings, quite sort of sanctimonious, and I wasn't big on the God talk, and I kind of felt people were talking about me when I wasn't looking, and I found it almost impossible to share. I started counting days in detox, which I later regretted, because I hit my 90 days with maybe 60 days of actual civilian life, and I could never think of anything to say, because I would sit at meetings thinking of wisdom, and by the time I thought of the wisdom, someone else had either stolen it or the meeting was over. And then I remembered I'd had this counselor at Smithers who said, one way to share is not to go in with a message or anything like that. She said, messages aren't good, but just start off with the words "I am." And I thought, well, I better do this, and then get your hand up and sit in the front row. So I started doing that, and I went to a meeting upstate and I thought, well, I'm really going to try this, and I sat down in the front row, and lo and behold, the person came and plopped down in the seat next to me. It was my former boss, and who welcomed me to AA. But I was very embarrassed. I didn't see why he was there. I only felt like I'd been caught. And I guess I did everything wrong in recovery, everything except one thing. I never picked up again. And it took me ages to get a sponsor. And I was complaining at some beginner's meeting about writer's block, and he said, why don't you just finish the damn thing? And he stomped out of the meeting. And I thought, well, I really need a Nazi like this. And it took me a while to find him. And of course, he turned out to be the sort of gentlest person you could imagine. But he he'd had cancer and it came back, and he was like dead in a month. And then I had a sponsor upstate who also got cancer and died fairly quick. And I was beginning to feel like Typhoid Mary, that that I was actually giving people cancer. And then I had another sponsor that was always hitting me for a job, and another one that was borrowing money and stuff like that. So it took a long time for me to... I don't know. I think it was like my will. You know, I really didn't want to turn myself over to the care of God because I didn't understand Him. And I'm having a bit of that problem now. It's you know, in the 20 years since then, I mean, I've done everything. I've been on vestries. I've swung the old therapist stuff and now, you know, I'm kind of off that and I find it very difficult to pray. And it's not that I forget to pray, it's because I just don't want to. And I think maybe that's the terrible 20s, you know. I feel like I get the touch of the Peggy Lees, like, you know, is that all there is and stuff like that. But I go to a meeting every day. I've got a great sponsor now. I've got half a dozen sponsees, some of which are better at using the telephone than I ever was. And it's just quite amazing to me how, even though I don't particularly want, you know, a higher power in my life, you know, how He won't go away. And, you know, I certainly spend my share of life on the pity pot. And yeah, I'm coming to see how, you know, there are two ways of saying, why me? You know, I can say, you know, why me and feel desperately sorry for myself. Or I can say, you know, why me in exaltation. I mean, you know, how come whoever sprinkled recovery on my head, you know? And over these 20 years, you know, I've had sort of depression, as we all have, you know, I felt, you know, sometimes I felt, you know, kind of sway on the edge of the subway, like shall I or shan't I, and stuff like that. And I don't know, there's just, I mean, looking back, those sort of depressions have never been triggered by anything that actually matters. In my sobriety, you know, I was diagnosed with cancer, which turned out to be a mistake, but I had it, you know, I didn't know that for a couple of weeks. I was diagnosed with diabetes, which is not a mistake, I have diabetes. And my brother died of this disease. You know, lost cousins and uncles, and I've been to a lot of funerals with a lot of friends who died of AIDS. And the real stuff I'm fine with. It's you know, I really understand the broken shoelace syndrome, because it's like, I don't know, I think it's my relationship with my higher power right now. It's sort of like, well, I can't really believe that He cares about the little stuff, you know, and then, well, I realize I'm a kind of a little stuff. And yeah, I'm a drunk among many. You know, I'm a worker among many. And one of the things I found doing my fourth step again, I mean, I've done like a couple, but this one was pretty heavy. And once again, I kind of dragged my feet on it. And I came to see that, you know, I'm not taking my moral inventory then. It doesn't matter what I did 21 years ago. I've made the amends I can make. It's what am I like now? What is my moral status now? And yes, I have a lot of good stuff. And yes, I have a lot of bad stuff. But and I like to say this, my bad has moved from felony to misdemeanor. But it's the misdemeanors that are going to get me. And so I have to be careful of them. I mean, I still pad my expense account. I still gossip. I still do stuff that bothers me. And I think the fact that, you know, I'm bothered is a sign of progress. And, you know, and then the other thing about AA is, Yeah, I don't know how long it took me to... I mean, I used to think I'd come in here on the first step, but I didn't. I came in here on the preamble. I wanted to stop drinking. And, you know, all those wretched slogans and corny phrases, you know, that awful poem, Footsteps and stuff like that, I've come to love them. And the more I used to scoff at them, you know, the more true they are, you know, like one day at a time, think, upside down, easy does it, yeah, right. And then the stuff you hear in meetings, I mean, the AA is just so rich with human recovery. And, you know, I remember the first Bill Wilson dinner I ever went to, some of the speaker said, you know, alcohol had given him wings and then it took away the sky, which is true of me. And then, you know, AA doesn't open the gates of heaven and let you in, but it opens the gates of hell and lets you out. And all of this kind of corny crap is beautiful. And it keeps me sober. And I'd just like to, half of you in this room are my daughter's age, but my kid was 7 when I got into, when I went into recovery. And I remember, you know, when I came home from rehab, she had a little sign that said, "Welcome home, Daddy," which I still have. And she used to do these imitations of me sort of passed out on the sofa and stuff. And, you know, I used to laugh, but, you know, it was really very painful. And I took her to meetings when she was about 8. My wife got stuck on a trip to Africa for a while, and I had my daughter for 3 months, and they were just tremendous months. And I used to take her to meetings. And I remember one meeting, when we took her to restaurants, we used to give her this little coloring book, you know, so she wouldn't bother the other customers, and she'd fill out her drawing with her different crayons and stuff. And I took her to this meeting upstate where the speaker had been a prostitute on the Alaska pipeline. And I looked down at my daughter's hand, you know, and the little fingers stopped moving. And it stayed frozen for the entire qualification. And then it got going. And I said to her later, I said, "Did you enjoy the speaker?" And she said, "Oh, yes, very interesting." And you know, and she doesn't do those imitations anymore. And she's really interested. She says, you know, "How was the meeting?" You know, it's like a village, you know, like it's a secret society in a sense. You know, I live on the west side, you're walking up and down Broadway and you're always meeting people you know from meetings. In fact, I sometimes meet people that aren't from meetings and have to be kind of careful. You know, there might be someone I met in my civilian life. And she sort of says, "You know, is he from the meeting?" And I say, "Yes," you know, and she's introduced me to a couple of her friends who are in the program now. I don't know, my life is just so full of blessings. And I don't know, I just don't feel deserving of it somehow. I still, you know, lately I was sort of feeling, well, I'm in the wrong job or I'm less than and stuff like that. And I had a really sort of terrific day today of you know, work. I'm still a journalist and I met someone I interviewed once and we had kind of put a few laughs about various stock market crashes and stuff like that. And I don't know, but it was still like, you know, like me in a suit. And yet when I come here, I'm amongst my own. We're all together on this. I mean, this incredible journey. And even though I'm not really sure who or what my higher power is right now, I know there is a higher power. You know, I've come to be like really glad I'm an alcoholic because I get to go to AA. And I really think, you know, that every meeting is more than the sum of its parts. And, you know, that margin, which is a pretty fat margin, you know, is our higher power. So I'd like to thank Helen for inviting me. Thanks very much.